Chapter 5. The Permanent Campaign. Planning for the Bush transition quietly began more than a year and a half in advance of Election Day. This process was led by the president's trusted, lifelong friend, Clay Johnson, whose background in business management — he had held executive positions at firms ranging from Neiman Marcus to Frito-Lay — served him well in this role. He had become the governor's executive director, equivalent to chief of staff, once Joe Albaugh had moved over to manage the presidential effort. Before that, he'd been the appointments director during most of Bush's governorship, overseeing the nearly 3,000 appointments to boards and commissions that a Texas governor makes. Johnson was able to do the transition planning discreetly, unbeknownst to the media and the public, and on a separate track from the campaign. The decision to start the transition planning early, with Clay in charge, proved highly beneficial, particularly given the extended election period. In large part because of Clay's detailed planning, the president and his team hit the ground running and got off to a successful early presidency. Clay later served as the White House personnel director and currently is deputy director for management at the Office of Management and Budget. One feature of contemporary politics had a profound impact on the transition, probably without Clay Johnson's intention or awareness, since he was neither a creature of politics nor had a background in it. I'm referring to the permanent campaign, a shorthand term for the way political leaders today work 365 days a year, year in and year out, to shape and manipulate sources of public approval as the primary means for governing. Because of the power and ubiquity of the permanent campaign, the jockeying for power during the 2000 presidential race did not end with the inauguration, but simply morphed into a different phase: governance. I don't believe that any of Bush's senior advisors took time during the transition period to read and absorb the lessons offered in the book, The Permanent Campaign and Its Future. I know I didn't. If they had, they might have taken steps to minimize the impact of the permanent campaign and prevent some of the problems that plagued Bush at defining moments of his presidency. Instead, the permanent campaign was firmly ensconced in the Bush White House from the beginning, virtually guaranteeing that it would play a major role in the administration. Edited by a pair of respected scholars at two influential Washington think tanks, Norman J. Ornstein of the conservative-oriented American Enterprise Institute and Thomas E. Mann of the liberal-leaning Brookings Institution, the permanent campaign was published in June 2000, partly in the hope it would help guide future presidents-elect and their teams as they plan their transition into office. For me, it elucidates one of the core phenomena of today's Washington. As the preface to the book explains, when the phrase was first coined, perhaps in 1976 by Pat Caddell, an assistant to Jimmy Carter, the permanent campaign referred to the process of governing in a way that builds and sustains public support for an administration and its policies. In this sense, continual political campaigning is the means by which any administration exerts a lasting impact on the nation, since policies that the public doesn't understand or support are likely to be short-lived and ineffective. However, the meaning of the term and the excessive way the permanent campaign is practiced have evolved in a disturbing direction. As government professor Hugh Hecklow explains in the first chapter of Ornstein and Mann's book, today's permanent campaign is a nonstop process seeking to manipulate sources of public approval to engage in the act of governing itself. In other words, campaigning and governing have now become indistinguishable. The aim of Ornstein and Mann's book, as Hecklow notes, is to make sense of this new meaning of the permanent campaign, to understand how and why it has evolved, to weigh its consequences for our ability to govern ourselves effectively, and to consider whether steps might be taken to ameliorate its more damaging effects. Understanding the permanent campaign's impact on governing, both in the White House and Congress, is integral to grasping how Washington has gone astray, becoming ensnared in constant partisan bickering and warfare, and in particular, how the presidency of George W. Bush wandered and remains so far off course by excessively embracing the permanent campaign and its tactics. The permanent campaign is a concept that would have baffled our nation's founders. When they created our system of representative democracy as enshrined in the Constitution, Hecklow notes, they envisioned an ideal system of governance in which disinterested legislators and high-minded executives would determine policy free from interest group pressures and partisan loyalties. They assumed that members of Congress would be citizen statesmen, serving their country a few months each year and tending their farms, businesses, or professions the rest of the time. They considered parties pernicious and hoped they would never become a feature of the American system. The word party doesn't even appear in the Constitution. They deliberately provided that senators and presidents would not be chosen by popular vote, but rather by elites in the state legislatures and the Electoral College. If that insulated them from public opinion, so much the better. In much of 18th century discourse, the people were the mob, a collection of ill-informed, emotional, self-interested individuals who could not be trusted with high affairs of state. The idea of running the government to cater to this mob would have horrified men like Washington, Jefferson, Madison, Monroe, and Adams. Today, of course, the game of politics has been dramatically redefined. The people are more deeply and directly involved in government than ever before. In many ways, this is a very good thing. Certainly, government is more responsive to the needs of the citizens than it was in the 18th century. But some of the ways in which the desires of the people, however defined, are reflected in governance are dubious at best. We all know many of the problems. Narrowly tailored partisan and other special interest groups influence Congress to shape policies for the benefit of their members, not necessarily the citizenry as a whole. Opinion polling is used not only to read the mood of the electorate and guide political leaders in the ways they communicate their messages, but also, at times, to determine the policies they will advocate. Continuous fundraising, a necessity in an era when expensive television advertising and other costly forms of communication are essential for political success, binds powerful interest groups and wealthy donors to parties and politicians in a way that often shuts out the needs of the average American. In this new system, governing is primarily focused, in Heckler's phrase, on manipulating sources of public approval, using such tools as the news media, political blogs, popular websites, paid advertising, talk radio, local organizations, and propaganda disseminated by interest groups to shape narratives to one's advantage. In the age of the permanent campaign, governing becomes an offshoot of campaigning, rather than the other way around. Bills at times are written as much to create talking points for boosting one's own party and embarrassing the opposition as they are to improve the operations of government or to promote justice. Presidential initiatives, from health care programs to foreign invasions, are regularly devised, named, timed, and launched with one eye, or both eyes, on the electoral calendar. Budgets are drawn up not solely with the pressing needs of the public at the forefront, but rather to reward political loyalists, punish enemies, and win votes in contested districts and states when November rolls around. The infiltration of politics into governance has been a feature of democracy from the beginning, but during the second half of the 20th century, it became increasingly prominent and pervasive. The administration of Richard Nixon, the first president to begin institutionalizing a permanent political operation inside the White House, exemplified many of the pitfalls of the permanent campaign, with its enemies list, its abuse of the IRS and the Justice Department for political ends, and the dirty tricks associated with the Watergate affair, which ultimately destroyed the administration. Too much of the permanent campaign mentality can cripple an administration. It brought down the Nixon presidency and nearly ended Clinton's, despite or because of what Washington Post media reporter Howard Kurtz called its spin doctors and well-oiled propaganda machine. And as I'll show in this book, it severely damaged the Bush White House, which arguably embraced and institutionalized the permanent campaign even more deeply than its predecessors.